it's about 8:30. This is what I learned over summer vacation.
To all ships at sea, this is John Wallace late at night at Holton Village.
8:30.
Wow.
I sympathize with Jim. Did it last night, he's doing it tomorrow night.
And all thank you, all of you, for staying up this long. Especially those of you who want to go to sleep. You know, if you fall asleep tonight, I won't hold it against you. Actually, I really never do. If you're that bored, just go to sleep. We've been talking about kind of how societies are ordered. And I've got a picture I want to draw, but I can't because I have. This is a forgery. Of a masterpiece. But several things have happened today, especially, and a little bit yesterday. In the sessions, I didn't get a chance to make Peter's session today, which I really was sorry about. But I was trying to make this session happen. But Alan and I had a conversation this afternoon. And he asked me a couple questions about what I was doing. And one of the questions he asked was, you know, I put this emphasis on sort of being neutral, where it sounds like I'm trying to be neutral. You know, like this is what happened, rather than what we want to have happen. Did you talk about normative today? Or Jim talked about normative. What we want to have happen as opposed to what we think is happening. And, you know,
I mean, it could be.
You know, I'm saying, life's over here. We're all on the train, the market, monopoly, military machine. And instead of leaving us all to death, I'm actually leading to life. I know that's not quite what you meant. But there's a question about how neutral is an economist. I can remember when I was an undergraduate, I thought economics was apology for the ruling class. And there is always a problem when you try to explain why the world is the way it is, saying, oh, the world is the way it is because it's the best of all possible worlds. That's Voltaire. And economists tend to talk about people being rational and pursuing maximizing rents, right? And so they tend to think of people as choosing the best options that they can choose. And so there are, in fact, in very simple kind of economic models, notions of maximizing social welfare. So this train's going this way. I don't have an answer to that particularly. I mean, because I'm trying to figure out what I'm trying to figure out. And it's okay if you don't think I'm neutral. If I'm selling you a bill of goods. Yep, capitalist, you know. Some people don't like capitalists. I don't think anybody really knows what it means. In fact, I think what most people think it means is what it isn't. But I'll talk a little bit about that tomorrow. But that is, I mean, I think that's a very important question to think about because it has to do with values and what you think. Right? And we'd all like to have the truth. But for these kind of problems, the truth is way too complicated for these kind of brains to figure out. So we do the best we can. And the other one was a question about equality and inequality. And somebody asked me a question about inequality on Monday. That's a really important question. And Al and I talked about it in terms of community. You know, is it harder to have a community in which you have lots of inequality, or when things get really spread out? And I don't know what the answer to that is. And I know that part of this process has in some ways to make the distribution of income in the world more equal. Right? Because we've got some countries that are getting richer because they're on this train. And we have some countries the bottom billion who just aren't catching up that are having real problems. Yeah, so they're really not even on the train, they're kind of back in the yard. And that inequality is growing. Does this process make societies more or less equal or unequal? That's a really tough problem to say because we don't know. Measuring inequality is not a simple thing. If you have a society in which one person has 99% of the wealth and everybody else has the rest, the 99% share 1%. In some ways, that's a very equal distribution. Okay? And that one who's out of the picture, he may not be in the community, or she may not be in the community. So how we think about inequality and its structures is really important. And I don't have a set answer that says inequality is good or bad. And certainly raises questions about how we interact with one another. But I will tomorrow come back and talk about what we mean by equality. And that's a really complicated concept, but I'm trying to get to the point where we can talk about equality in a couple different ways that may be helpful with respect to inequality. Last night, Jim talked about the politics of domination, the economics of exploitation, and the religion of legitimization. Remember that? Those were here last night. Or was Dan here? Earlier? What? Where is he? It was getting ice cream. Oh, there he is, see? Oh, no, that's not Dan. Yeah. I'm sorry. He looks like Karin. He's getting ice cream, so I could really dump on him. That pyramid, you know, he had the rich Romans and Jewish landlords up on the top, and then there was 5 levels to the pyramid. Okay. That's one way to talk about these kind of levels, but it's a way of talking about how society is structured in which society is static. You don't know how anybody got from one level to the other, and you don't know what's happening with people distributing themselves between the levels, and you don't know how that society keeps itself stable or structured or changes. Okay, and then we've assumed something about the structure of society without actually trying to generate an explanation for it. Follow? So last night I was trying to get you to think about a way of thinking about how societies are structured so that you could see an underlying logic to why there was a hierarchy. Because every time there's a hierarchy, there's going to be potentially people wanting to bump each other off, Ron and John. You know, the powerful people at the top don't think, oh, we're powerful and therefore we'll get along. But guys at the top, they're the ones who cause all the problems. So we want to be able to not just have a horizontal structure for society, but we also want to understand how it's structured vertically and how it changes over time. And so these are I'm an economist and a historian, but I also do political science, and I read anthropology and some theology and some cognitive science and some psychology. And I try to study Latin, but it doesn't work. And what I've learned, I'm not a multidisciplinary person. I mean, I'm concerned with answering one particular set of questions using whatever tools are at hand. But what I have learned about being multidisciplinary or reading different fields is that you have to respect the fact that people who have devoted their lives to working on something understand something about it. It's kind of like Holden. You gotta listen to people enough to begin to understand what they're saying, even though the first time it hits your ears, it doesn't sound right. If every time you hear something that doesn't sound right, you stop, you don't learn very much. Different ways of thinking about problems have different languages. Economics and political science and theology have really, really different languages. And in fact, the way economics is used is really different across economics and theology and social, lots of different places. So one of the tricks to being interdisciplinary is respecting the fact that people who have devoted their lives to doing this and are recognized in their field actually have something to say. And if you're too stupid to figure it out, you can't say they're stupid. In economics, this is particularly a problem because economics is kind of an imperialist field. It's taking over social sciences in some ways. And so there's a tendency for Congress to say, well, that's dumb. You know, you got to think about this. And I hope I don't sound like I'm doing that. And then that has then some issues about neutrality, right? Because some economists are really pinheads. They have one way of looking at the world. You know, they're like this. And that's the only way they can look. Now, believe me, economics does not have a monopoly on pinheadedness. but we want to be aware of those kinds of things. In part, remember, I'm going to draw it very small. But you know our hockey stick graph? This is a transition that makes this. And all of us are worried about the way our world works and what it does to us. Okay? We all are. We don't want to be cogs in the machine. We don't want to be fodder in a gun. We don't want to be exploited by a monopoly. Right? We don't want to be dehumanized by an impersonal market. But we got to remember that some of this stuff is the price of getting some of this stuff. And I don't mean the bad part of this. I mean, we've restructured our society in a way that lowers infant mortality, that lengthens life, that produces more civil rights. Okay? And we cannot, in good conscience, say that our society has gotten worse on those measures. We can say all societies have problems, but we can't say that this has not come with some significant improvements in things that we would all agree are good. And they're not simple to understand how that happened. So I want to talk about, before I'm going to erase this now, in part, this transition, which I hope I'll be able to talk about at the end tonight, looks this way, and it's perfectly legitimate to look at it that way. There's different perspectives on thinking about what happened. I'm trying to have a neutral, maybe not neutral, I think it's neutral. I'm just trying to understand why it happened. Because if you want to go to China, India, South Africa, Latin America, and make this happen, you got to understand what was going on. And it wasn't that people got nicer. They were just as corrupt and just as selfish and just as everything as you and I are then, 200 years ago. You can read with things. Oh, never mind, I don't want to go there.
What's the horizontal axis and what's the vertical axis?
I don't know. No, this is time. And this is whatever you want it to be. Income, per capita income. Population, the inverse of infant mortality, life expectancy, height, all kinds of measures of human well-being take this big shoot up around 1800. I'm sorry, I should never, well, I think I just wrote green pen. I should always put labels on my axes. Okay, last time we kind of talked about the transition 10,000 years ago when we began to see how we got larger societies. How many were not here last night? Okay. I'm going to go through really quick. In a society when there's lots of violence, most societies with lots of violence have very small groups, 30 people or more, they have personal relationships. The way in which societies can get bigger, and probably getting bigger, is you create more opportunities for violence. Is for two powerful individuals, we'll call them Ron and John, or one person. And they are powerful individuals. What they do, the problem is the Rons and the Johns of this world don't trust one another, and they shouldn't because they're powerful. And if Ron puts down if his left hand puts down the rock, his right hand will smite him. this man's name is actually Ron John. For those of you who weren't here last night, I'm sure that all of you who were here last night will always remember. Okay, so that they divide the world up, and They get resources, land, labor, capital from their part of the world, the two circles. And what happens is, because they're getting, are able to exploit or extract the productivity of the people in their part of the world, if they fight, the productivity of their group goes down. And that means that Ron and John can see in each other's circumstances. Ron can credibly believe that John won't fight because he can see if John fights, John's going to lose a bunch. Because his organization, his group will become less productive. Those are the little J's, the little R's, the members of the community. Now, what I said last night in very general terms is that there's a second thing that happens here. One, and my mom was asking me about this last night, where'd the violence go? Okay, and this is a social arrangement in which you're creating incentives for people to not to be violent. Okay, Ron and John are the two most dangerous people, and we've created an institutional arrangement, a form of society in which, because of the way Ron and John interact, they can see, they have an incentive not to be violent. Okay, not only does Ron have incentive not to be violent, but he can see that John has incentive not to be violent. And that enables them to coordinate. Coordinate's really a better word than cooperate, because they're still the two most dangerous people in the society. They're going to remain heavily armed, and of course, because they'll come to one another's aid, they can probably coerce any of the people in their organizations. But they're not really coercing them. They're trying to set up a system of incentives to make their organization more productive. Now, I want to give you a really good example of this. Where are my glasses?
On the piano?
No, yeah, they're in my sweatshirt. They're only in a few places. Okay, how many of you have read the Book of Esther? The Book of Esther, what's the king's name? I'm putting you on the spot.
It was Ahasuerus.
Yeah. Ahasuerus, I don't know. A-H-A-N-E-U-S, something like that. It's a long kind of name. He'd be on the watch list if he checked in at the airport. He's the king. And he has a lot of wives, but he's got this one really beautiful wife, his major wife, and they're having a big party, and he calls to have her come in. And the king has to ask people to come into his presence, and she doesn't come. And the king goes, "What?" And so he's really upset. So he orders her away. He doesn't kill her, does he? No. He orders her away. And he does American Idol talent search. Okay. But and that's the story. I don't want to spoil it for you. But the very last sentence of the very last verse in the first chapter is the king, who rules 151 nations or 121 nations, issues a proclamation to be posted in all of his nations. That in every family, the husband is in charge. Okay? Now, that's precisely what I mean by the dominant coalition providing support for organizations. Families are organizations. And what the king is saying is that in every family in my kingdom, the primary person, the person who represents the family, the person who must be listened to, is the male, father. And I will back him up. So if any of you guys out there, your wife does what my wife did to me, I'm behind you. Is that good? Ooh, yeah, that's really complicated. Okay? In early 19th century America, the laws treated the family as a unit. And the only legitimate representative of the unit was the head of the household.
The male head of the household.
Well, yeah. There was different states had slightly different rules, but it was usually the male head of the household. And that included not even family members. So if you had slaves or servants in the household, they were the legal identity of the head of the household. Now, remember we talked last night about how organizations are based on relationships, but the form of the relationships that they can take place may depend upon the kind of rules that are there. So if you think about families, which are together, and every family who's unhappy is different, as Tolstoy tells us, right? And their relationships between the mother, the father, the children, and the servants is conditioned by the fact that if that family has to go get the third-party services of the state, who will the state listen to? The head of the household. That's the rule. Okay? You may not like it, but that's the rule. And does that make families more or less viable?
Yes.
More. As organizations. Everybody knows what's going on. Now, in early 19th century America, what happened is some states began to allow women to sue for divorce for cruelty, then later on for drunkenness. Later on, it began to allow women to own property that was not conveyed to their husband when they got married by default. They allowed women to own, to form businesses as sole proprietors that they could do. And so as they did that, what happened to the family? It really changed. It became a different kind of organization. Now, did the relationships within families change? Maybe. You know, families, husbands and wives and children loved each other. These rules probably didn't affect them at all. Their family was held together by the value of their relationships. But the rules about what happened when the relationships changed were changing over time. The way in which you support organizations here is by the center, or by the powerful, being willing and able to support certain kinds of relationships within an organization like the family, within an organization like a business, within an organization like the church. So the ability to do that, to form organizations that can be supported, and here I want to remain really neutral because the moral and ethical content of the organizations can be wildly positive or wildly negative. And believe me, the values that we have are not the only set of values in the world. So there are plenty of societies with organizations that look unethical and amoral to us, but they're perfectly accepted in those societies. They're perfectly legit because they're ways of ordering things, the ways of doing things. I'm not talking about kind of a relativism here. But it's different societies, patterns of different societies really affect how people view the appropriate kinds of relationships. It was a great case in Rome. I'm going to talk about Rome tonight. Stan here yet? Good, okay. Because he's got a lot of the pictures with the Romans. And the Romans, boy, the Romans gotten trashed this week. You know, the Romans are evil. They're occupiers, you know, they'll string them up, you know, crucify them. They're there. And the Romans actually are kind of not that bad. And they're very important to look at because many things in our society derived from Roman society, or ideas about how things worked. So, in there's a great book. Any of you read The Prince by Machiavelli? Okay. The Prince is a really tiny book written for a prince. I'm going to run out of time, but I don't stop with my introduction. the heavy-duty book about political science is called Discourses on Livy. Discourses on the first 10 books of Livy. Livy was a Roman historian. He wrote about the history of the Roman Republic. He lived in the time of Augustus Caesar. He was an adult then and writing then, just as the Republic was disappearing and the Imperium was being established on a permanent basis. And he talked about how in the Republic, the generals that were elected, who would go out and fight, were always patricians. You know, they were from the elite class of people, and the plebes, who really weren't just everybody else. They weren't the masses. They were people who had property and standing in the community, but they were not patricians. We're always agitating to have plebeian councils so they could get in on the action. Because what happens when you had that victory, you know, you came back, they built you an arch, they gave you all this money. They wanted to be in it. So they passed a law saying you could have plebeian councils, and they had voted. They voted, and the plebes got to vote. And they voted in all the aristocrats, all the patricians. And Livy says, well, what's going on here? The next election, well, it turned out the Romans were really superstitious, and when you went into battle, you had to take the auspices, right? You had to kill a chicken and put the blood on the ground or the bird flying across or something like that. And guess what? If you weren't a patrician, you couldn't take the auspices. So even though you were a plebeian general, you weren't in that society. You were literally not capable of taking the right auspices and being trusted by everybody. So even the plebes, who could have made themselves better off by electing one of their own, wouldn't. They didn't want to lose. Right? They didn't want to go into a battle where they hadn't gotten the right signs. So these kinds of organizations really matter. They really matter in what people do. We can come up with a zillion of examples of this. What I want to talk about for a while, in the time remaining, is how the church got organized. When you think about this kind of world, which I'm going to erase, the scale, the size, and the complexity and the sophistication of the organizations in society go a long way towards explaining their both economic and political development. Remember, I talked about how there's really two islands. So there's the developing world, which moves back and forth along in here. They are natural states all the time. And then some societies manage to make this discontinuous transition to what I'll call open access societies a little bit later on. In most of the world is in this box, 85%. And are they all the same? No, they're wildly different. You know, there's South Korea at the richest end, and there's the Democratic Republic of Congo at the lower end. There's countries that have per capita incomes of $10,000 or $12,000 a year. There's countries that have elections really regularly, you know, that are contested and that are fair. And there's countries that can't ever run an election. There's countries with dictatorships. So there's a scale here, a dimension upon which these societies differ, and we think that the major difference is organization. That in really fragile societies where violence is a real problem, it's very difficult to form durable organizations that are not tied to an important person. Right? It really is a Ron John world. You want to get the powerful actors who are potentially dangerous and create privileges that they possess directly, so that they have an incentive not to be violent. As societies get more organized, however, you get more durable organizations, you get the vertical circles become stronger, and then you may get something called a government, or you get things called tribes, you get with norms and rules and that sort of thing, and you get durable forms of organization, so over time, those organizations actually persist. People have some expectation that 5 years from now, the same organizations will be around. What was really important in medieval Europe in that respect? What was the most important organization that would be around?
Church.
The church. As you move further over to here, you actually get very complex organizations that are allowed to form on their own, as long as they're in the elite. And so that the Ron John world provides a set of services for organizations that can be quite sophisticated. So when you get to that point, and I'll talk about this a little bit later, then you may be in a position to move to here, but I'll talk about those conditions in a little bit. All these natural states are personal. Personal relationships really matter. Although personal relationships are often not so much person to person, but I know that you're a Lutheran. I know you belong to the Jets and the Sharks or the Montagues and the Capulets or the Democrats or Republicans. That is, I can place you in the context of one of the organizations. And because I can place you in the context of one of the organizations, I can deal with you with a little bit more trust, but I also can possibly know that the relationship between my organization and your organization will discipline us both. Okay, so that's kind of where I want to go in this. But I'm going to do it with the church because I think it's important for us to understand. The early church was a mess. Well, I know it was a mess, but it wasn't very well organized. It was organized into small groups, right? And those small groups were small enough to be sustained by relationships. They tried to have rules. They had some different sets of rules. They had some Christians that weren't even in churches at all. They were living out in the deserts of Egypt. Lots of different outcomes. I'm by no means an expert on that. Things really begin to change for the Christian church in 311 AD, or Common Era, when Constantine, as emperor, declared that Christians shouldn't be prosecuted. and declared that it was his religion. He called the Council of Nicaea in 325, which produced the Nicene Creed, which we still say today in various dimensions. And in fact, that was a big deal. Constantine himself went to the council because it eliminated lots of other possible viable interpretations of what the Bible meant. Like, you gotta have a triune God. That's it. You don't? You're not a Christian. I believe in the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost. In return for that, Constantine is actually using the power of the coalition to make the organization of the church more sophisticated. In not the next emperor, but a couple down the line was a man named Theodosius. And he declared, and I thought I had the year in my notes, but I don't. Sometime around 380 AD, that the Christian church was the official church of Rome. Here's the it's a great declaration. It is our desire that all the various nations which are subject to our clemency and moderation should continue the profession of that religion which was delivered to the Romans by the divine apostle Peter, as it has been preserved by faithful tradition and which is now professed by the Pontiff of Damasus and by Peter, Bishop of Alexandria, a man of apostolic holiness. According to the apostolic teaching and the doctrine of the gospel, let us believe in the one deity of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, in equal majesty and in Holy Trinity. We authorize the followers of this law to assume the title Catholic Christians. But, as for the others, since in our judgment they are foolish madmen, we decree that they shall be branded with the ignominious name of heretics and shall not presume to give their conventicles the name of churches. They will suffer in the first place the chastisement of divine condemnation, and the second, the punishment of our authority, in accordance with the will of heaven, shall decide, which in accordance with the will of heaven shall decide to inflict. Well, this is your church, right? It is. Believe me, this was important for our church to be here today. So, in the end of the 4th century, not only did the emperor accept Christianity, he said, I'm going to support you, all you church fathers out there. It wasn't just that the weight of the state became here, it's that the organization of the church was now sanctioned officially. And the status of any other competing organizations was illegal, heretical, burn at the stakeable. In the famous, most famous Roman law code, does anybody know what a code is? There's got to be a lawyer here somewhere, like my sister. A codification code is a consolidation of all the laws in existence into one place. So most states in America have a code, and they codify their laws once a decade or something like that. So in the 6th century, actually the Rome had already fallen. The Goths and the Visigoths and the Semigoths had come in, and they'd taken over the western part of the empire. The eastern empire was still together, and under a series of emperors, they recaptured Rome for a period of time. And Justinian, who was emperor in the beginning of the 6th century, in 527 promulgated the Code of Justinian. And guess what the first document of the Code of Justinian is? Theodosius' statement about the church is the official church of Rome. That's the first thing in the code. So there was a close relationship between the church and the state. And I want to say state here rather than government, because the Roman government was sometimes in, sometimes out. It wasn't always real concrete. And these were mutually supporting organizations. This came, Rome continued to decline. We got another religion rising in the Mediterranean basin in the form of Islam. There are continued waves of invaders, mostly overland at this time, our, you know, our Norwegian and Swedish forefathers will come later and begin to pillage Europe. The empire, and the Pope in particular, because where does the Pope live? Italy. He lives actually at this point in Ravenna. He's not in Rome. But there's a Western Pope, and there's an Eastern Patriarch. And nominally, the emperors of Rome, which are now all in the East, recognize the Pope and the Patriarch as founders of the church. And the Pope sort of recognizes the emperors. And there's a nominal relationship there. But as the invaders get closer and closer, the Pope has got people in Italy running around. Spain is conquered by the Moors, by the Islamic forces. They're pressing up into France. And the Pope needs to stop this. The military forces in Europe need to stop this. And so in 751, there's a king in what we would call France, but it was called Merovingia? No. The name escapes me because I'm not a really good medieval historian. There was a king, and his major officer was a man named Pippin. And the Pope, Pippin was more qualified than the existing king. And so the Pope comes in and says, the king is dead. Pippin's the king. He doesn't say the king is dead. He displaces that. And the Pope recognizes Pippin as the king of France, or the king of the Franks. Pippin cemented this alliance by coming to the aid of the Pope in Italy, sending troops to Italy to defend the Pope in Ravenna, sending an army to deal with the Lombards, who had taken an army to the walls of Rome. In 754, the Pope, quote, this is from Aubrey Brand, a famous economic historian, the Pope solemnly renewed the consecration which Boniface had bestowed upon Pippin, and on penalty of excommunication forbade the Franks ever to choose a king who was not descended from Pippin. Pippin's son was Charlemagne. Okay. Charlemagne becomes the king of the Franks. He goes to Italy. And on January 1st, 800, the Pope crowns Charlemagne Holy Roman Emperor. Now, you got some severely intersecting circles here. Right? We got the Pope, the King, and the Pope and the King are part of the dominant coalition, as are their allies, and they're heads of organizations. When the Pope crowns Charlemagne Emperor, what is the Pope saying to Byzantium and Constantinople and the Eastern Emperor? Naughty, naughty, boo-boo, you're not my emperor anymore. Go soak. Washed in, soaked in. I like that. Right? The Pope is saying, we are declaring our independence. How do I have the gumption, the gall to do that? Well, it ain't because of theology. It's because I'm in alliance with a guy who's got an army. We can take care of ourselves. We don't need you. We're going to break up. We're going to take what had been Pan-Mediterranean Empire, in which the West had crumbled, and the West is going to rise, hopefully, by separating itself from the East formally. By pledging themselves as protectors of the Catholic Church everywhere in the world, the Carolingians, Charlemagne and his followers, gained entry into all of Christian Europe, an entry that Charlemagne made masterful use of. Through diplomacy and war, Charlemagne built a political coalition based on control of land and personal obligations. Military service and land tenure became closely linked, forming the origins of the feudal system. I think I'm quoting myself there. So don't really take it too seriously. That what happens with Charlemagne is you get a pan-European political unit that is, in fact, a pan-European religious unit. So Charlemagne starts telling all of it. So the word count comes from the counties that Charlemagne established as administrative districts. So you get this close relationship between the military power and the religious power. And in fact, Charlemagne starts the tradition of what are called proprietary churches, where he asks the major players in the political coalition to endow a church and to fund a church. He issues charters for monasteries. Official recognition that a monastery can exist usually gives them exemptions from taxation, the right to do certain things. But as Charlemagne builds a series of organizations, and to be accurate, we need lots more circles here, some of which are religious and some of which are secular, all tied together in the same network. The church is validating this, just as Charlemagne is validating the church. This is, last night I said, in a natural state, politics and economics are the same thing. Politics and religion are the same thing. Or at least in the sense, and this was, Alan was really great on this today. Right? What's the bigger piece that of this church? Is it in our way? Or is it helping us to live like Christ lived? This is clearly an organization whose structure is being driven in part by its mission as Christians, and part because it's part of the social order that nobody wants to have break down. Even the peons aren't going to be well served by religious wars or invasions. And in fact, what happens after Charlemagne's death is the empire gets divided up into three pieces. It starts losing it, and then the Norwegians and the Vikings start invading in the north. A series of invasions in the south. It gets the Vikings who settled in France. They call themselves Normans. They invade England in 1066. We get lots of, what do we call that period?
The
Dark Ages. Right? Because we don't have a lot of records, because the church, what was happening to the churches? They're getting smaller. They're getting ransacked and that sort of thing. So that this organizational structure had become quite fragile. And if this arrangements become fragile, we would expect to see the organizations becoming more personal. So the fact that you have a proprietary church, which means the local baron agrees to build the church, he also agrees to protect the church. And the church goes along with that. Does that make sense? But it becomes a very much personal relationship, not impersonal. Not all that well organized, because it's tied to the identity of the baron, and maybe I tied to the identity of the priest. If it's a cathedral, it'd be a tie. I never get this right. Bishops are in cathedrals, and archbishops are in
monasteries.
What? No, abbots are in monasteries.
Archbishops
are. They're in cathedrals too. Archbishops and bishops, and so archbishops are being appointed by local lords who are protecting the church. Proprietary church system. Now, the church always goes back and forth between wanting to be magnificent and rich and wanting to reform itself. And so there were constantly people saying we should reform the church. And in the 11th century, a Cluniac monk named Hildebrand became Pope Gregory VII. He was a reformer. He was elected, he was chosen on the basis of a reform platform to get rid of simony, which is the sale of church offices for money. And there's a word, what is it, Red, when priests marry? they did. When priests would take wives, take women to live with them, he didn't want that either. Now, both of these were
non-celibate.
What? Non-celibate, that's not the word. There's a sin for when priests do this. Okay, so he wanted to reform the church by getting rid of money and women. And so that was his platform. And then he says, how are we going to get rid of money? We're going to prevent local lords from appointing bishops or priests or archbishops. And this is called the investiture crisis, because the legitimation of a bishop would be by the investment of the king or the local political power. And so Gregory says, we're not going to do this anymore. We're going to have only the Pope can appoint bishops and archbishops. Now, this was a big deal for the church, because all the bishops called the Pope what? The Bishop of Rome. He was just the Roman among equals. He wasn't the Pope. He was just one of the guys. You know, he had some historic claim to this. And so when the Pope asserted that only the Pope could invest legitimacy in bishops and archbishops, says, sprinkle the water on them, right? Sprinkling, the person who gets to sprinkle the water on you has power. The kings have been sprinkling the water. Now the Pope says, I'm going to sprinkle the water. You can think of this, and it's often told as a story between the Pope and the king, between the church and the state. But in fact, in some ways, this was as threatening to the church and the bishops, who were going to lose their independence, as it was to the state. A lot of things happened. King Henry IV, the Roman emperor, tells the Pope to stuff it. The Pope excommunicates him. Henry goes down to a place called Canossa, which is a papal palace, and waits with a hair shirt on for 3 days in the snow until Gregory lets him back in, and then lets him back into the church. And Henry goes back to Germany, and all kinds of stuff is breaking loose, because, in fact, the Pope is inciting German leaders to disavow Henry. So you get church candidates in Germany. It's a mess. And what happens as a result of this is a change in the constitution of the church. That you're going to get. You end up with a council being called and agreeing that the Pope will appoint bishops and archbishops with the consent of the king. So the king is no longer appointing directly. The Pope is appointing, but with the consent of the secular lord. What happens to the structure of power within the church? It changes. It moves more to Rome. What happens to the powers of the kings? Not a lot, because they can veto just about anybody they want. But a bishop who wants to be a bishop now has to please the Bishop of Rome, not just his local king and church. You get a movement then after this towards a kind of organization of the church. In which the Pope and the Archbishop and the Bishop and the King, when they're installed into their office, they swear an oath, and the coronation oath. And for the church, the Pope or the Bishop says, I promise not to alienate the Christus without the consent of the appropriate body. Now, what becomes known as the Christus is the property of the church, the economic assets of the church, the land and the buildings, which are re nullius in Latin, that is, things that belong to no one. They belong to the church collectively, in a sense, corporately. And in their coronation oaths, the bishop is saying, I will not sell the property of the church without the approval of the college king, or cathedral college. I'm rusty on this one. The Pope won't sell the property of the church without the consent of the council or of the College of Cardinals. Now, what does that mean? Well, it means that within the organization, some relationship between a body in the organization and the Pope has been established, in which both of them have some control over economic assets. So when the Pope wants to make a decision, he's going to have to get the consent of the College of Cardinals. When the bishop wants to make a decision, he's going to have to get the assent of the Cathedral College. You know, how many of you are pastors and had to get the consent of the church council? Right? What that does is it creates two bodies, two groups within one organization that are potentially there to balance each other off. The notion that the bishop will appoint the cathedral college now all of a sudden becomes unrealistic. Because if he does, there's no sense in having the cathedral college be there, because if the bishop can appoint all of them, then what? Getting their consent doesn't matter. And that means that the Cathedral College has to be an organization that persists through time. In some ways, independent of the bishop. That is, the see has to be a durable organization. And the church, in solving the problem of the investiture crisis, begins to move towards understanding that church bodies are durable through time. Now, what happens then And this is happening, the king starts swearing these kind of coronation oaths. And what occurs is the transformation of the papacy or the kingship or of offices from things that are personal to things that are somewhat impersonal, or anonymous might be a better word. The Pope, as the Pope, cannot alienate the property of the church without the permission of the College of Cardinals. But the Pope, as a person, owns wealth that he can buy and sell however he wants. The Pope has two bodies. One of them is mortal, John, and one of them is incorruptible. Right? It may not be internal, but when John dies, they get a new pope.
Judy.
Pope Judy the First. Now, what's happening is that you're creating an entity called the Pope, who has an incorruptible body, and the entity of the person who fills the office is going to die and croak. And this person, the incorruptible person, is who you can bind with these relationships. The question will be, is this person, the actual mortal body, constrained by this person, by the laws and agreements that constrain this one, or is this person, the Pope or the King, as a person, above the law? In fact, there's these great pictures in the Middle Ages in which they'll draw a picture of the Pope. The Pope's head will be at the top of the picture, and there'll be a picture frame around his body, and society will be in the body, and then there'll be his feet at the bottom, signifying the fact that the Pope is above the law. In Rome, who was above the law?
Caesar.
The emperor. And laws flow from the emperor. The emperor can't be bound by the law if he can change the law. But if what pleases the prince is law, then they can't get him underneath that frame. Now what's happening in this durability of creating entities within organizations, which is happening in both the political and secular realm, kings are doing this too, is you're beginning to create durable organizations in which, rather than the personality of the individual who's actually in the office, you're creating an identity which doesn't change when its occupant changes. That doesn't mean the occupant doesn't have influence on what's going on. They certainly do. But it's like, what happens when the President of the United States changes office? Well, you don't change the laws. You just put another warm body in there. He's on TV most of the time. So I don't know how he makes any decisions, right? We have a very strong sense of office, and that office is independent of personality. This is beginning to create an identity in which the identity of the office of the Pope and the King matters as much as the personal relationship between the Pope and the King. That is, we're structuring an organization. Are these organizations free? And they support human freedom, and are they open to the masses? And all? No, they're not. No. Right? They're still really, really privileges. And these offices carry with them enormous personal privileges. And the structure of society is to create organizations which have offices that structure them. So every aristocrat is not just an aristocrat, he's also the head of a big organization. His land, his servants, his staff. And so as the church begins to do this, in parallel with the state, you get more sophisticated organizations. Now, in 13, for a while, the papacy was in Avignon, and it moved to France, because Italy wasn't so stable. I don't know all the details. And it moved back to Rome in the 14th century. And in 1378, the College of Cardinals selected a pope, Clement VII, who was a Roman, an Italian bishop, archbishop. And then, a few months later, they decided, oh, we made a mistake. We don't like that guy. And
and they elected another one. Now, in the constitutional structure of the church, the College of Cardinals had the right to elect a pope, and nobody really understood that. Did they or did they not have the right to elect two popes? Well, they did elect two popes. They elected an Italian one, they elected a French one, and the College Cardinals split, and some of the Cardinals went back to Avignon, some of the Cardinals stayed in Rome. And this is called the Great Schism within the church. What happens when you've got two popes? That guy's a heretic. Well, you know, within the structure, there was a large crisis.
Emperor Sigmundus, Sigmundus, and the King of France got involved. They called council in 414, called the Council of Constance. It was a church council. The church council was made up of all the big players in the church, the bishops, the archbishops, the abbots, and that sort of thing. And with the support of the King of France and the Holy Roman Emperor, they decided to ask all the current popes to step down. And they nominated a new one. And then they said, every 5 years, the council is going to meet. And if there's any problems with popes, the council will decide it. So, they were trying. Get the Pope under the law, right? That the council would be the ultimate authority, but they left it up to the popes to call the councils, and guess what? They wouldn't call them. That sucker couldn't be gotten under the law. He's back up there. So this was the Council of Constance in 1414 to 1417. Again, they're trying to create a constitutional structure for the church, in which the default power lies with the council. In Britain, this would be called the parliament, right? In France, this would be called the Estates General. Right? We're beginning to create multiple bodies that have to consent with one another. The fiscus, the Christus, the property of the church. The fiscus, the property of the state. So you created a mechanism for rent sharing that can make these two bodies within an organization sustaining. In the church, it doesn't work to get the king under the pope under the law, because the pope decides not to call councils. There's only been five since then, in the last 600 years. One was the Council of Florence, which was fairly small. One was the Fifth Lateran Council, which was called to deal with, in part, Martin Luther. The Council of Trent in 1545, which was essentially the Counter-Reformation, which made dramatic changes in the structure of the church and said, this is dogma, this is how you're going to do baptism, this is how you're going to do marriage, this is what Catholics do. We aren't like those people. And then they stopped having councils. So the First Vatican Council in 1869, and guess what that council did? They declared the Pope infallible. Now, which chair did they declare infallible? Which one? You can vote. How many think this one? How many think this one? And how many didn't vote? Running for governor of California. this one. Okay, the infallibility of the Pope is not the infallibility of the person. It's the infallibility of the
office.
Okay. Now what's happening in this process is that we're beginning to get durability of organizations. And in fact, at some point, the organization acquires what we can call perpetual life. That is, the organization is independent of the identity of its members. What kind of organization in American society has that property? A corporation. A corporation is a legal person. At law, it's a person that has rights and responsibilities. Those of you who have read the Citizens United decision by the Supreme Court a few months ago declared that corporations were persons, and as persons, they had the right of speech, and so
their ability to contribute to political campaigns couldn't be regulated. Not a very good decision. Okay. Many people don't, and now it's now 9:30, I have no time left, and I'm finally getting into corporations good or bad. Okay. That's because I have my 20-minute introduction. I do this all the time. It's okay. What happened in the struggles to define what the church was and to define what states were in Western Europe, they had evolved a system in which the organization became in its identity, became independent from the individual. At some point, it was possible to create a perpetually live organization. Importantly, that meant that the organization could live on beyond the lives of its members. It could commit itself to do something in the future. So if you buy life insurance from a life insurance company that's in a corporation, when you die, everybody involved in your transaction might be dead. Right? And how do you know that the corporation is going to honor its commitment to pay your children or their heirs the life insurance money?
It's still alive.
What?
The corporation.
The corporation's still alive. But how do you know it's going to honor its commitment?
Third party.
Potentially third parties. But what is the, okay. You guys are good. You're learning a lot. What does the third party have to be? Yeah, it's going to enforce the contracts. But remember, we've created a perpetually live organization to sell the insurance. What does the third party have to be as an organization?
Perpetually live.
Perpetually live.
Say that again.
A perpetually live corporation who sells you an insurance policy, you will not believe credibly that your policy will be honored when everybody's dead, unless the third party is also a perpetually live organization. Now, that means here, this is really important, is that by creating a perpetually live college of cardinals, or cathedral canon, or parliament, that is an organization whose identity was independent of the people who were part of the college of cardinals, or the parliament. They possess rights and privileges. These are pure natural states organizations. But the privileges were embedded in the organization, not in the identity of the individual, so that as the individual cycled through, the organization stayed the same. You couldn't do that with just one. You needed at least two. The church had lots of trouble doing this because of the Pope and the notion of being the body of Christ on earth, in which Christ would speak. And how did Christ speak? Well, he was going to speak through the mouth of the Pope. You couldn't put that guy under the law. So for a long time, this guy was almost as important as this guy. But in the larger society, as sovereignty becomes transferred to the political system, you begin to get perpetually live organizations in the state, but that required perpetually live organizations in the other parts of the society as well. Now, a real important part of perpetual life is that the identity of the Pope is personal or impersonal? Impersonal. You treat all popes the same. So it doesn't matter who they are. When they step into the shoes of Peter, right, they take on these fixed characteristics. The characteristics can change through time, but they don't change with the occupant. In most societies in which violence is really important, the organization of the dominant coalition is inherently personal because you got to get the powerful guys incentivized. So when we hear of the president of the Democratic Republic of Congo, we have in mind a president whose powers are fixed and impersonal, but in fact, the president of the Democratic Republic of Congo is over here. He's trying to hold his coalition together.
damn the rules. There aren't, you can't do that. You may not be able to support any games. So that in the end, this transition in natural states. As they get better organized, at some point they reach the possibility of creating a perpetually life organization, or more accurately, a network of self-supporting perpetually life organizations. And that means that that society is actually able to create and support impersonal offices. If you're over here, in which violence is really a problem, and your organizations are tied to Ron, or John, or Ron John, right? You have impersonality. Now, is there any way you can begin to even think about treating people equally? No. Because you gotta know whether you're in Ron's camp or John's camp. Who you belong to, who you identify with is really important. So that means that an organization that's impersonal doesn't exist. Peter was talking about the rule of law. We talk about all kinds of things in which we treat people equally. And treating people equally really means treating everybody the same. And that means treating people impersonally. Oh, that was one of the bad things, right? In impersonal marketing. But until... I'm over my time, so I'll stop. I'm not going to stop yet. It's really, really, really important to understand that you can't get to equality if everybody gets treated individually. Because if everybody's treated individually, they're going to be treated personally, and you're going to treat everybody differently because you're treating them personally. Right? The essence of personal relationship is you don't treat everybody the same. I talk to my mom one way, my sister another way, and my wife, who isn't even here, another way. And that's because my mom and my sister can listen to me, and it drives my wife nuts. But if you've got personal relationships, you can't make those work if you treat everybody the same. So you got to have an organization capable of creating identities which are impersonal before you can think about moving to a society that can truly have impersonal markers. They can truly have impersonal laws. And that's what we'll talk about tomorrow. Thanks.